Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Is this the time to go looking for a sale of luxury items such as yachts, exotic cars, huge mansions with three or four swimming pools, fancy watches, RVs, things like that?
Well, I think it's certainly getting to be a lot of people listing those items for sale. I think we're still very early in this credit crunch. That's kind of been something that's just picking up in the last while. If you remember, so the central banks have been increasing interest rates since March of 2022. So we're just, you know, over 18 months into this. And this is where I've mentioned this several times, but because of the lags of how long it takes for changes in interest rates to filter through the economy, because not everything is floating rate debt, right? So a lot of stuff is fixed terms for a period of a year or 2 years or 3 years. So it's not really until those loans start coming up for renewal that people realize, oh dear, I don't have, for example, an increase in the equity in my home in the last little while, and I can't therefore refinance and withdraw money to pay off some of these credit cards or personal loans or vehicle loans or boat loans. Or, I mean, people were really buying everything on credit during the pandemic thanks to the free handouts from governments, but also thanks to the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years. And so what happened was a lot of people did a lot of reckless things with money, unfortunately. Instead of using low rates to get out of debt, they tripled and quadrupled the amount of debt. And the real estate cycle, of course, looked like it was cooperating with them, because the more people that borrowed to buy, the more people that were, you know, borrowing against their principal residence to buy a secondary residence, whether that was as a vacation property or as a rental property, or Airbnb and all that sort of thing. That was this self-fulfilling prophecy of driving up demand for houses, which of course was supportive of price gains. And the more people who took secondary properties off of the long-term rental market and used them as I say, vacation or empty, you know, capital banks, or even as periodic rentals for short-term websites, that kind of thing, that also subtracted properties from the long-term rental market. And so you had this decline in the amount of properties that were available for regular families or regular people to rent as a house. So you had a big pressure on both prices and rents, and we saw that escalation in the cost of living, which fed into the CPI, of course, which is one of the reasons, again, the CPI being the consumer price index, is a lagging indicator. Again, it takes time for all this to filter through into these measures of how the government or the central banks look at the cost of living and how much it's increasing, but by the time it starts hitting, we're already sort of at peak rents, peak prices. We know that prices in Canada in terms of the home market peaked back in 2022 and have been declining since. But the CPI, of course, is still this backward-looking thing that's measuring the changes that happened, as I say, into the peak. So now we're in this period where it's kind of all unraveling, because the opposite has happened. households have been drawing down the excess savings they had from the government handouts and stimulus that went on during the pandemic. They've been spending their brains out on that. At the same time that consumption has increased the cost of goods and services, because again, we had bottlenecks because we couldn't keep up with the pace of demand. It was artificial spending, if you will, because it wasn't earned money so much as it was gifts and largesse from the government. So you really saw this big boost in the cost of living. So now people have been drawing down their savings because they're in the midst of a rate shock, which has tripled their carrying costs in some cases on debts that they took out at the lows of the interest rate cycle. And at the same time, wages have not kept up with the increase in the cost of living. So they're now looking at their income statement and saying, oh my goodness, I've got a big deficit here. My income is not kept pace with this increase in the cost of whether it's the carrying costs for your mortgage and other debts, but also things like insurance on everything, housing insurance, vehicle insurance, you know, all the catastrophic weather events in the world, all the auto thefts that are going on, all of that has really hit, is a big crunch on the insurance market. And insurers are now laying off people, especially their marketing departments, because they don't want to actively seek new policies because they're not able to make enough profit on a lot of the math is not favorable. So you've got this increase in the cost of living and flat wages, and now we've got a tick up in the unemployment rate. So it's really pressuring everyone. And of course, the thing they did with a lot of this free money was buy these non-productive assets. So, you know, crazy watches, boats, you know, helicopters, personal aircrafts, like, and I always get a kick out of it when people say, oh, well, the wealthy don't care that, you know, that interest rates have gone up. They pay cash for everything. No, they don't. There's a percentage of people, a small, teeny percentage of people who actually use cash to buy personal consumption items, but a lot of people finance to buy those. Now, whether they do that directly through consumer loans, a lot of them borrow against, as they say, against their real estate, whether it's, you know, variable rate, HELOCs, that kind of thing, to have this cash to buy these goods. So I'm not surprised to see that we're getting a lot of websites noting a massive influx of all the things that seem to be in short supply during the pandemic, right, when no one could get their hands on an RV and this bottleneck really drove prices higher. Well, those people are now turning around and putting those things for sale because they're realizing that they're asset heavy and income short. And so the more that those get listed, just like in the real estate market, you know, the bid here is much below the ask on many properties that people are wanting to unload now because they're, you know, realizing they're over-levered. The problem is that the qualification, even if someone wanted to buy your property, you know, unless they're an all-cash buyer, the reality is that they can't qualify for mortgages at current rates to pay anything close to the prices that people are hoping to get for these things. So you're seeing this big increase in the supply month over month, which is not what realtors were predicting, right? They were saying in general, and the realty agencies were saying, oh, you know, it slowed down a bit in the summer, but we expect we're going to have a busy fall. Well, that's not happening because there's a dearth of able buyers because the price point is still way too high. And we're starting to see power of sales tick up across the GTA in particular. The Toronto Real Estate Board is reporting power sales have increased 10% a month since July. So, you know, I'm not surprised to see all these websites posting this, you know, big jump in things like Ferraris. Like the fact that regular people were buying Ferraris is just mind-blowingly dumb, but that's what people tend to do when they don't have much financial acumen and they're, you know, they're living in a world where they think debt is the answer to, you know, their aspirations with regard to acquisition of things instead of doing things prudently. So anyway, that's why you've got a bunch of stuff coming on now. And the price point, as I say, that the potential bid is much further below the ask than is currently appreciated. And I think that this is going to continue to intensify the stress and the liquidation mode. I think we're going to see a lot more things listed for sale. I'm noticing it in every kind of asset when I look around. And I think that if you're looking to buy any of that stuff, the answer is have the cash, but also be patient, because as I say, this is early days in this. We know that the surge in bankruptcies that we're starting to see, the defaults that we're starting to see, that's likely to continue over the next many months. And so as that pressure intensifies and as price discovery becomes more apparent, you know, when people realize, oh God, there's 10 of these things I'm trying to sell just listed this week, you know, that's where you start to get some reality checks and people having to lower prices to clear, to liquidate, to get cash. And that's the crunch that's really unfolding right now.
I think, Danielle, you advised people clear out your debt some time ago and keep cash handy for bargains. Is it time to hunt for bargains, or are they going to get better?
Well, I guess what I'm just saying there is that I think we're very early in this clearance mm-hmm. process. So, yes, I think there's bargains coming. And I've said this before, across the board, because everything was so overbought in pretty much every category, the price declines are happening across the board as well. And so, yes, there's going to be an opportunity here to put cash to work to the extent that people have kept cash liquid and available. Unfortunately, most people don't plan for these inevitable downturns, and they tend to be fully invested at all times. And most asset managers keep accounts fully invested. And so, you know, it's quite common for people to have maybe 5% cash in an investment portfolio. So everything is falling in price right now. So how is one to take advantage of that? And I'm suggesting to you, we're, again, going to see this continue for a while here. So I wouldn't be jumping in, you know, any moment soon kind of thing. But we're certainly getting huge progress in the right direction. I mean, when people, you know, there's been a lot of revelation that year-to-date asset markets, you know, they rallied into June, and they've been selling off sharply since. And there's a lot of talk about the pressure on bonds, that bonds have been selling off, and government bonds in particular. And that is true. We've seen the worst 3 years for government bond returns that we've, you know, ever seen in history. But relatively speaking, equities have been doing much worse. So that's not really appreciated here. When people speak about dividend paying stuff as if it's defensive, and this is the sales side of the investment world, right? They're telling people that you need to have more defensive holdings, by which they mean dividend paying equities. They never tell people to hold government bonds. Now, of course, the rate shock, as I say, has hit all asset classes, from Rolex watches to airplanes to vehicles to, you know, to real estate, bonds, and equities. But here's the difference. Only bonds have a maturity value. Only bonds have a prescribed rate of interest that has to be paid, or the payer goes into default. Everything else is either doesn't yield any income, or is negative yielding, i.e. it costs you money to carry the asset or store it or insure it or, you know, keep it. So there's no actual net benefit in holding it unless the price is going up. Well, the prices are all going down here, right? So relatively speaking, like I was mentioning, Canadians have an obsession with, for example, financials, right? Because it's 30% of our TSX stock market is in financials. So if someone, you know, has a diversified, so-called diversified portfolio of Canadian stocks, they're holding about a third of their money in the financials. Well, the financials are doing terrible in this environment, right? Financials have come off about 20% from the peak. Now, again, you may say, great, is that an opportunity to buy them? Well, I think that we need to wait a while longer here, because this credit cycle has lagging implications, as I've spoken about here, which means that, for example, in 2009, we saw financials fall over a sort of a two-year period from 07 to 09, and they declined about 46%, and that was the bottom at that opportunity. So we're maybe halfway through the decline you could see in the financials, which means we're probably, you know, got a significant downdraft coming for the TSX as that price correction continues. The same for REITs. You know, Canadian real estate investment trusts have been widely popular while real estate was the most held asset in Canada, but the REITs have come off about 30%. So again, that's coming in the right direction. The yield there is around 5.6%, which is a huge improvement over where it was a couple of years ago when the shares were priced so much higher. But again, in the cycle I'm describing, we've got, you know, we haven't even got to central banks cutting rates yet here. We're still in the so-called tightening bias, right, where they're still rolling off assets monthly and quantitative tightening on their balance sheet, and they're still, you know, Jay Powell today was speaking at a luncheon saying, you know, we've done a lot, but we may have to go further, we're not sure. Like, I personally think they've done enough. They've done an incredible amount in terms of the tightening, and the world is in a state of cardiac arrest from what they've done, whether people are aware of it yet or not. And these financial assets are all worth less because rates are so much higher. So when you've got a risk-free rate around 5%, then a 5% yield on the REITs is not that attractive because they still have significant price risk to the downside. And also, they're dividend paying, which I always make this point. Dividend paying means is not the same as an interest coupon or an interest payment that's prescribed or required on a debt instrument. Because in a dividend paying instrument, in an equity, there's no maturity value. You're stuck with market value, whatever that happens to trade to. So it falls when the central banks go back to cutting rates. It typically falls significantly. And also, the dividends can be cut or suspended at any time, and they should be. When companies get into financial trouble, you know, they don't have to make those dividend payments. So they're not etched in stone in any way. So you have much less security in terms of income stream and principal. So if they're just yielding the same or less than the risk-free rate, the money market rate, the, you know, the guaranteed rates, they're not attractive in this environment. And that's the competition. For so long, we had zero interest rates where, you know, it was all suppressed, so there was all these incentives for people to not save and to spend their brains out. That is no longer the world we're in. Now we've had this massive repricing, and the consensus is currently predicting that the economy is going to continue to expand and that inflation is going to be sticky and persist. And that's why all the income-producing assets have sold off, because they're saying, oh goodness, how high are they going to raise rates? But here's the thing. At some point here, unemployment is going to become, you know, considerably higher, in which case the central banks are going to be forced to stop hiking and go back to trying to ease. And that is when government bonds reverse their sell-off and rebound in price while they're still paying you their stated income, their stated interest payment, while everything else continues to fall. Right, so that is what we're expecting here, is to see that the risk asset side has significantly more pricing to the downside. And that includes, you know, corporate debt, the junk debt side. Again, yields have come up significantly because they've sold off by like 20% and more, but they're nowhere near the type of decline we are likely to see in a typical recession. They're maybe halfway through. And as they fall, that's when the income yield rises so significantly, and that's where the bulk of then the great opportunity comes after that price decline.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, we had a listener question. Is this a blood on the street situation for bonds, or is that still to come? And if it is, how do you defend yourself?
Well, the blood in the streets part, I guess I would say yes, in terms of the sell-off in the government bond side. As I say, it's been the most significant three-year decline that we've seen in history. And historically, there's never been a time where they didn't rebound in a year following a two-year back-to-back sell-off. So the odds of a price appreciation here, again, because we're near the end of the central bank tightening cycle, even if they tighten one more or two more times, they've done so much already that we're certainly near the end of what they can possibly do here as the economy slows down. So to say that there's been this cardiac arrest that's impacted all income-bearing instruments, bonds and stocks, that's absolutely true. In fact, relatively speaking, if you look at the way equities are still priced, and again, you know, this is broadly to do with a few names that have held up. So the seven tech companies that are the largest weights in the S&P 500, for example, are the only thing that has risen year to date. The other 493 companies that make up that index are actually flat year to date. The TSX is flat year to date. So don't forget, these things all sold off significantly in 2022. So to say they're flat year to date means that we're still in a bear market for most stocks worldwide. And it's only these few handful that has held up the benchmark that has made it look like things have bounced back, but even they are significantly off their peak. So yes, there has been some significant work to the downside on many of these assets, but relatively speaking, stocks are still priced for negative returns over the next 10 to 12 years, believe it or not, because they are still so expensive and their earnings forecasts are still so above the norm, above the long-term mean, that this compression in price that I'm speaking of that's likely to continue and typically continues for, you know, about 2 months before the recession starts is when the stock market really starts to roll over hard, and it continues to do that into the bottom until about 4 months before the recession ends. Of course, by the time we're getting to the bottom and the recession is, you know, priced in, no one expects anything to rebound, but that's when the best opportunities come. So right now I would say government bonds have done a ton of work to the downside and provide great opportunity for the dynamics I'm describing over the next year, for example, whereas stocks, I think, have significantly further to come down before they will be attractive and worth any kind of risk in terms of putting capital in them. So that opportunity is yet to come. The bond opportunity, I think, is here. The corporate debt side, not so much. Again, that tends to follow the equity side. So I think, relatively speaking, the best thing to do right now, I mean, we're holding these government bonds that I'm speaking of in our accounts, and yes, they've sold off, but we haven't had long duration ones here, so overall our accounts are actually positive year to date, and you know, the gains or the recovery that comes when they go back to the cutting side will put back a significant portion of value into our accounts while we're collecting the interest. So that I'm not that concerned about at all. But the people that are holding some of these, and this is where it gets difficult for retail people that are trying to do this themselves or are dealing with traditional advice providers, because they don't tend to buy individual bonds or government bonds like provincial and municipal issues, this sort of thing. That's not typically available to the retail investor. They don't have the inventory available to them through discount sites. They tend to look at things more in mutual funds or ETFs. And the reason we specifically got out of ETFs of bonds in 2020 was because we could see that they were starting to do things like lever up inside the funds or take out lines of credit to magnify returns or to provide liquidity so they wouldn't have to sell if people started redeeming and this sort of thing. And that all makes fixed income in a different risk category than what we like to have it in accounts. We like to have, you know, the most security and transparency of principle possible. And so it's difficult for individuals because you might buy an ETF of bonds and think that you're doing something defensive, but inside of it, it could have a significant exposure to commercial or corporate debt, which is still in the repricing phase, or it could have leverage inside of it, which is something that would magnify losses if it didn't go your way. So I think for the average person, I think that you could look at some of the, if you're looking at ETFs, make sure they're concentrated on the highest credit quality, so the investment grade, the governments, and the highest quality corporates, but not any of the high yield or junk stuff at this phase. That's when you would look, you know, after the equity market is sort of made further downside work, that's when you can look to add things like, you know, the JNK and the some of these more risky, the CPD, which is a preferred share equity ETF. Again, it's come off about 27% so far, but it's a long duration asset, so it also will fall, you know, trade lower as this credit crunch continues and people start trying to sell their assets to get cash. So I think it's just, you know, right now, if you can get cash in money market, if you can have, you know, expertise where someone can buy you some of these government bonds, I think that is the best recommended opportunity that I could see in this environment. And it's actually very compelling. And it's something we've had this good since 2007. So there's some exciting parts in there, but it does take a certain amount of expertise, which is hard to find in the investment world because they're always trying to sell you the riskiest stuff.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.